Hey, hey, I'm Steve.
And I'm Aaron.
And this is Better Place Project with Steve Norris.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Welcome to the second episode of Season 2. Before we get started, we wanted to give you all a quick update on last week's episode, the kidnapping of Hotel Rwanda hero Paul Rusesabagina. The HRR Foundation, in that episode, by the way, we interviewed Corinne and Anais Kanimba, the daughters of Paul Rusesabagina. The HRR Foundation, who is working to help free him from this kidnapping that took place, they put out an article a couple of days ago earlier this week where they have disclosed now that since early November of last year, Corinne has been receiving WhatsApp messages and direct messages from a gentleman claiming to be a prison guard at the prison where Rusesabagina is being held. And he's claiming that the only way he can be saved is an escape, and they want to help him escape and help the family get him home, and they are asking for money in return. When I say they, she has since been contacted by a couple other people claiming to be guards there, and they're asking for money for a vehicle to help get him out. Thankfully, Corinne has not responded to any of these. She's turned all these messages over to the Belgian authorities as well as the FBI. Concurrently to this, last week, the Minister of Justice for Rwanda in a television interview said that they have reason to believe that Rusesabagina is trying to escape. So this is all an entrapment that the Rwandan government is known for, claiming that a prisoner is trying to escape, and they even try to entrap the family to get them sucked into replying to these messages, and then the prisoner all of a sudden ends up dead. So the Rusesabagina family is speaking out in this HRR Foundation article. They say that if Paul Rusesabagina is killed while, quote, attempting to escape, unquote, the world will know that it is actually another Kagame assassination of a jailed prisoner. The article goes on to say, quote, efforts like this are exactly the kinds of things the Rwandan Investigation Bureau engages in to both entrap people, but also to set up potential extrajudicial murders. Paul Rusesabagina's family wants to make it clear that any harm that comes to Paul is the direct responsibility of the Kagame government. Please sign the petition that is going to be sent to President Biden. You will find it in last week's episode notes, and we will keep you up to date on any new developments in this story. Moving on to this week's episode, Aaron, tell us who we've got today.
Alan Graham started Mobile Loaves and Fishes in 1998, a social outreach ministry that provides food and clothing, cultivates community, and promotes dignity to men and women in need. He and four of his friends boldly answered their call to love your neighbor by delivering meals to men and women experiencing homelessness from the back of a green minivan. Since its founding, MLF volunteers have served more than 5 million meals with a sight of hope to men and women living on the streets of Austin, and the organization has spawned similar food truck ministries in other cities across the U.S. Alan also is the lead visionary behind MLF's Community First Village, a 51-acre master plan development in Northeast Austin that provides affordable permanent housing and a supportive community for men and women coming out of chronic homelessness. Alan is a published author of the book Welcome Home, One Man's Journey of Discovering the Meaning of Home. He also is the host of the Gospel Con Carne podcast, which explores the woundedness of society through untold stories of individuals who have encountered homelessness.
What a charismatic and inspiring human being Alan was. What an interview.
He truly was, and he's such a kind person. He addressed common misconceptions about people experiencing homelessness, and he really changed my worldviews on all of that and their experiences. and how important it is to treat everyone with dignity and respect, no matter what their circumstances are.
Totally agree. And the thing that resonated with me is their belief that homelessness is a human issue that requires a human response. And we talk about this in the conversation, whereas Amber is their chief goodness officer, says in one of their videos that housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. And when you all hear what Alan and his team have been doing the last couple of decades, it is going to blow your mind. So without further ado, let's get right to it. Mr. Alan Graham of Mobile Loaves and Fishes.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Good morning, Alan. How are we doing?
Yeah, we're doing awesome. Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. It is an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. And we understand you are in Austin, in your community, as we speak this morning, are you?
That's correct. Yeah, sitting inside my office, right in the middle of the community.
And how is your weather this morning?
Cloudy and a little muggy, chilly. And we're actually supposed to get temperatures in the teens in the next couple of days, which is extremely unusual for Austin, Texas.
Yeah, that is. It's generally pretty mild in the wintertime. So.
Yeah.
But all right, well, we'd like to get started. As we just conversed before we started recording here, we were joking about there isn't a question that you haven't been asked before that we are quite sure we're not going to stump you because you do interviews all day, every day and whatnot. So you started to tell us a situation where you were asked a question that kind of stumped you. Can you tell us about that? Or
yeah,
a unique question that was asked you?
Yeah, so it was great. And, I'm somebody that'll go talk anywhere. And I get asked to speak to Cub Scouts and Brownies and kindergarten classes. And
sure.
So I'm at this kindergarten class, and I always start off with the video, 4 or 5 minute video. And I'm in the video, and usually when the kids see me, and usually I'm behind them as they're watching the monitor. And then I'll appear and they'll turn around and they'll look at me like in awe that I can't
believe the guy on TV.
Yeah. That the guy that's on that screen is in this room right now. And then I give a little talk, at the end of it, kindergarten style. And then I open it up for questions. And this little girl raised her hands and I said, yes, ma'am. And she goes, Mr. Graham, what was it like serving the homeless on horseback?
And Are you serious?
And I wanted to go, hey, how old do I actually look to you? Hey, my generation landed a guy on the moon. The horseback deal was quite a while. Anyway, just
hilarious.
Yeah. Kids are the best.
Yeah, it was the best. Yeah.
And did Abraham Lincoln help you in the cause when you first started
Mobile Loaves and Fishes. Yeah.
That's too funny. We assume you weren't on a horse and you didn't have to drive a horse and buggy to get to your first or deliver your first, bread and food to the homeless. Can you take us back, Alan, to, I understand there was a coffee chat discussion 20 some plus years ago that kind of was the impetus that the spark that started all of this. Can you take us back there for a moment?
Yeah. So sometime probably spring of 98. My wife and I were having coffee with a girlfriend of ours from church, and she was telling us about a ministry in Corpus Christi where on cold winter nights, multiple churches would come together to pool their resources to distribute to the men and women that were living on the streets. And at that moment, and to something that I can only attribute providentially, the image of a catering truck entered my mind as a distribution vehicle from those of us that have abundance to those that lack abundance. And I didn't share it at the time. I'm a serial entrepreneur. My wife is married to a serial entrepreneur. Even by 19,
thing.
Yeah,
Because I'm a serial entrepreneur too, so I know what she goes through.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And so I'd taken her up and down the roller coaster plenty of times, from complete abundance to just, you know, kissing bankruptcy and, you know, all of that. And but this idea would not go away. And as a serial entrepreneur, I'd go to bed at night with this thing on my mind, wake up in the morning thinking, God, you know, you could have this in every city, in every state, in every church that's got a homeless and working poor population. And then finally, within a couple of weeks, I finally shared it with Tricia, and she just looked at me as a beautiful person that's married to a serial entrepreneur would, and just responded, "Oh my God, here we go again." Because at that point, she could see that I was on point and wasn't going to let this thing go. So,
right. And I read somewhere that I'm assuming these were possibly in the early years, but I know as of a few years ago, you had spent over 250 nights spending the night with the homeless. Can you describe that very first time you did that, and then ongoing, what did that experience teach you?
So it was in May of 2003, where I led a group of about 14 or 15 of us out of Westlake Hills, my church, St. John Newman Catholic Church in Westlake Hills. Westlake Hills is like the little neighborhood, or one of the neighborhoods, very upper middle class to, billionaire class in that neighborhood. And I had been contemplating wanting to go and spend the night out on the street. So I put this deal together that we call street retreats, and about 15 of us were dropped off on the streets on a Friday evening to spend three nights out there. We were dropped off in a park in downtown, and we're standing around kind of flopping around trying to figure out what to do, and there are homeless people around, and this one guy comes up and he's talking to us, and he just looks at us, and he could tell, even though we had backpacks and stuff, that we were
rookies.
We were not homeless. And he just looked at me and said, "What are you assholes doing out here?"
Really?
I also have my oldest son with me, and he's 14 or 15 at the time. And this guy that's challenging us, his name is JP, and he goes, "Do y'all want to go dumpster diving with me tonight?" Now, my only paradigm of dumpster diving is, you know, we're going to go eat out of a dumpster. That was my version. And as I'm, choking down my no, my son blurts out, "Yeah, that'd be awesome." And so next thing you know, me, my son, and another guy are moving around Austin with our buddy, new buddy, JP. He's pushing a grocery cart, calls it a buggy, and we're jumping in and out of dumpsters looking for recycled materials. And what I got to witness was an extraordinary, unbelievable Puritan work ethic from a guy on the streets, you know, whose paradigm you would say is lazy. You know, why don't you just go get a job? And here he is working. And so there were so many stereotypes that were broken during that 72-hour period of time. That it was mind-blowing, but the biggest thing were the relationships that were being developed between us and the men and women on the streets. And I wanted more. I was learning so much from them. And that's really what led to me leading a number of these retreats. We've done so many, have led well over 2,000 people in Like I said, I've spent over 250 nights on the streets, and it's a paradigm shifting thing for Mobile Loaves and Fishes, because I just think that we understand that population unlike anybody.
You kind of brought this up a little bit, but I wanted to know, what are some of those common misconceptions that people have about homelessness, and what can we do to try to eliminate those stereotypes?
Well, the biggest one is that nobody on the face of the planet chooses that lifestyle. And what oftentimes is communicated as choice is completely, in reality, resignation. We've all resigned ourselves to being who it is that we are, even those things that we may not like about who we are as individuals, but we have resigned that that's who we are. And so the homeless find themselves in that position. They're proud of who they are as human beings, and they will tell you, no, I've chosen this lifestyle, but nobody on the face of the planet would ever do that.
In fact, on that subject, you told a story that I heard once that a 12-year-old boy lying in bed.
Yeah. So I'll use myself as an example, but I do it ubiquitously across all humanity, across all time, that no one ever at 12 years old was laying in bed at night in that little moment of twilight between being asleep and being awake, laying in bed at night, fantasizing, looking out their windows at the starry skies and dreaming about being a crackhead, a glue sniffer, a prostitute, and chronically homeless on the streets. They didn't do that. They were like me. I had 12-year-old dreams. That there were three that were important and still exist. One is I dreamed of being a rock star. I played guitar then. I have guitars now, and I will never be on stage playing those guitars. But if a great AC/DC song comes on, there Alan is on stage with that guitar in hand, jumping around like Angus Young or Malcolm. And
I'm a musician too that had those same dreams. I play a little guitar and keyboards, and absolutely.
Yeah, It still exists. I played football at 12, and you know, watching the Super Bowl the other night, there were plays where I could visualize myself in those plays, and I can tell you that I'm about 5'9", 175 pounds. There is zero DNA of a professional football player in this deal. And then the last, but the fantasy, the embers of those dreams are still alive. And then my last piece was, I love airplanes. I love smelling jet fuel. I got a private pilot's license back in the 1980s. And if I look up in the sky and see an F-22 Raptor screaming across the sky, I can see me in the cockpit of that $500 million airplane. But let me tell you, Uncle Sam cannot see me in the cockpit of that. And so the embers of all of our dreams are still there. And the question is who's pouring the fuel in order to ignite those dreams? Now, my dreams didn't turn into a football player or a rock star or a fighter pilot, but I get to live a dream-filled life every single day because fuel was being poured on those embers. But because of our fundamental belief that the single greatest cause to homelessness is a profound, catastrophic loss of family, there was no one there to pour fuel on those embers. And in essence, that's what we do, is we lift people up off the streets, and we try to pour fuel onto their dreams to let them know that they are valued, Because none of us are doing what, I mean, some of us might have dreamed of being a firefighter at 12, and now we're a firefighter, but most people aren't even close to anything that they dreamed about being.
Can we talk a little bit about when I first heard about Mobile Loaves and Fishes, and I went to your website, and I lived in Venice, California, which I'm sure you're aware, you know, which has a very large homeless community, and so there's always the debate about how to solve this problem and how to provide housing. And when I saw your community, the Community First video, which just blew me away, and seeing what a beautiful thing you've created there and the difference that that made, it's the first time I've really seen a solution that makes sense. And Amber says in that video, which I love her title, your chief goodness officer, Amber said that housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. So can you tell our listeners about Community First and how that came about, and then tell us about all the incredible things that that you are doing within the community?
Well, it begins with the fundamental philosophy of, you know, if you want to understand homelessness, we must understand what home is. And I think from a cultural point of view, we struggle greatly with that here in the United States of America. And we believe foundationally that there are eight characteristics to home. One, a home is a place of permanence. We're not really meant to be that transitory. Home is a dwelling place. I like to say that when I cross over the threshold into my home, it's as if I liquefy and move into every nook and cranny of my home. Home is a place of embodied inhabitation. If you come to our home, it's got all the stuff from the 40 years that my wife and I have been together, and including the thing on the wall that we measured the kids with as they were growing up, because today when we get together, they measure dear old dad because I'm shrinking by about a quarter of an inch. And home is a place of hospitality. If you come to the Graham house, we're going to unfold hospitality in abundance. And home is a place of stories and memories. It's often said that the mortar that holds the bricks together of even the most impoverished home are the stories and memories that flow from that home. And then home is a place of safety and refuge. I can tell you that I live in this community with 220 formerly chronically homeless men and women, and my house is unlocked right now, wide open.
That's awesome.
And then home is a place of orientation, and I've been in some places around the world that are just unbelievable, mountaintops, cities, Europe, you name it, but my compass is always oriented to Austin, Texas. And then last and not least, home is a place of affiliation and belonging. It just kind of turns out that you and I like to be around people that have a similar set of shared values. So when you've been homeless, you've battled addiction, mental health issues, all the things that are out there, you can relate better to people that have had similar shared experiences. And in none of those characteristics does it talk about the four walls and the roof. We need those things. Housing is necessary, but it's really insufficient to being at home. And so that's why that line, housing will never solve homelessness, but community will, is so important to who we are.
Yeah, and on that, that was the other thing that seemed like such a powerful difference that you are doing in your community. And that is, rather than just setting up this housing and sending all the homeless people there, you're integrating people like yourself and others that are living in the community that are there also as a support system that, as you described in one interview, that can give somebody a ride to go see a family member or you know, just to be there to support them. And in fact, how many people, or what is the percentage of people that live in the community that don't have a homeless past?
Well, out of the 250-60 people that are here right now, 50 of those are missional.
See, that's amazing to me. That is huge.
Yeah. And then people in line to get in, it takes about 9 months to a year to discern into that process. We want to make sure that people know what they're jumping into. Because this isn't Nirvana here.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
So I read recently on your website that you have a retention rate of 80%. Can you talk a little bit about that? How you are able to do that with us all knowing that typically with drug addiction, there are relapses. Sometimes I think you had mentioned that it's 7 or 8 times is the average that someone will relapse into drugs. So what rules do you have, if any, regarding allowing active addicts or people that are still fighting addiction in the community?
Well, first of all, we welcome the active addict. We actually don't have the power to allow or disallow drugs. That's a legal thing and a criminal thing, and we don't have the power of search and seizure, and we're not the police, and we're not going to be the police. And our fundamental philosophy is what you do in the privacy of your own home and in the privacy of your own life is your business. As long as that behavior does not spill out negatively into the community. And at any given time, with 250 people here and growing at 10 a month, there's probably 4 or 5 people that are, you know, problems in the community. And we extend as much grace and mercy as we possibly can for those half a dozen. And but if it gets to the point where we have to exit them from the community because they are a disturbance to the community, we will do that. Most addicts, like the addicts that you know, are relatively compliant.
Sure.
Yeah. And I don't like the word functional addict. There's no such thing. But the people that you know that are alcoholics and drug addicts seem to get along okay in the world. They present a lot of dysfunction to their families. I mean, you have one in your family. I don't know who yours is, but there's one in your household. I mean, not physically in your household, but maybe.
Right.
I certainly had it in my... No, nobody's immune to that.
Yep, I would agree. And can you tell why you feel that is important that when we've all come to a stoplight and we're standing there and there is a homeless person there, how we as individuals should treat that person? So many times, I think in our society, we look the other way. We're afraid of it. We don't know how to handle it. Or if we're walking down the street and they're sitting there on the sidewalk, can you give our listeners some tips on how we can improve how we interact in these situations? And also, if we give them money, for example, why we shouldn't be concerned about where that money is going?
Well, I think, first of all, from a philosophical point of view, it's all about acknowledging the human person on the street corner. So my first line would be acknowledge them. And you can acknowledge them by shooting the peace sign, waving at them, rolling your window down, throwing a God bless you out there. How's your day? What's your name? My name's Alan. Hey, my name is Aaron, or my name is Steve. And then the next time you're up there, next thing you know, you're rolling down the window and you're saying, hey, Aaron, hey, Steve. And a relationship might develop. And then it may be sometime that you've got the bandwidth. Why don't you you hungry? There's a McDonald's right there. Why don't you meet me at the McDonald's? I'll buy you a burger.
Mm-hmm.
You could carry bottles of water, socks, packages of crackers, whatever you want around in your car. It's really a tool to connect human to human, heart to heart. So is a dollar or quarters. Are $5 or $20. Now, look, if I was living on the streets and had to live in that abject misery, I may very well be trying to figure out how to anesthetize myself from that misery. And where you and I get to go to the local pharmacy and buy our drugs, or we get to go to the dispensaries now all over California. So if I want to buy weed, I can do that. It's still illegal here in Texas. And if I want to go to the liquor store and buy a bottle of wine so I can have wine tonight or whatever, you know, we get to do all that. Why shouldn't they be able to do that, you know, as well? So I'm just not hung up on that. The other thing is I don't know if that guy standing on that street corner got a young wife around the corner with a baby in the car and they just need baby food and diapers.
Sure.
And what I'm saying no to by withholding my money. So be generous. It's really a one-on-one relationship between you and God, and what they do with the money, that's a one-on-one relationship between them and God. So,
right.
Yeah.
I read a book many years ago called Sync, The Emerging Science of Spontaneous Order by Stephen Strogatz, and pretty amazing book. And when I was listening to an interview you had done a few years back, you mentioned spontaneous order, and it totally caught, because I don't hear that term and that phrase very often. So can you talk a little bit about that and how it pertains to the homeless situation here in America?
Yeah, well, it led, spontaneous order really is kind of the way that I understand it. I haven't read the book, but it's fundamentally my leadership style. How do you create what we're doing? How do you create a vision, mission, values, and a set of goals around what we're doing that I can invite the whole world into that vision, mission, values, and goals so that you bring your gifts, you bring your spontaneous gifts? And it's really why this community has emerged, is through the allowance of that spontaneous order, allowing the creativity of others that are also laser focused on the work that we are collectively doing to bring their gifts and talents to the table. That's kind of how I see that.
Yeah, and it definitely seems to me that you've accomplished that, Alan, because, you know, in spontaneous order essentially is the emergence of order out of chaos.
Yeah.
And so it is chaotic living under a bridge and having, you know, someone maybe try to rob you or be, and always be in fear of that. And then to go from that into order of having a place to lay your head at night, having some chores, having some, and I love that in your community, you've got an auto shop, a car care facility, you've got an organic garden, you've got, so can you touch a little bit about that, all the jobs that are there for the members of the community to earn a living and pay their rent and have that dignity in their life?
Well, when you think about the panhandler standing on the street corner, I turned 65 in December, moved to Austin in 1976, out of the Houston, Texas area. And there were no panhandlers in Austin or Houston or Dallas or L.A., for that matter. You had the stereotypical downtown, chronic, inebriate, sometimes schizophrenic, alcoholic type downtown, but it wasn't ubiquitous the way that we see it today. It used to be that we had men and women standing on every street corner selling bottles of waters, newspapers, flowers, cow skulls, cow skins, and velvet Elvis art.
Yeah.
And today we've outlawed all of that, so that the only remaining bastion of entrepreneurialism left for people who live in extreme poverty is the First Amendment free speech right to beg. If you go and to Mexico, if you drive south into Tijuana right now, you're going to get assaulted the moment you cross that bridge by a gauntlet of entrepreneurs selling everything. And yes, you'll have a few beggars on the street corners, but nothing to the extent that we have in the United States of America. What the hell is wrong with what's going on here? And so I contend that we prevent them from being entrepreneurs. And what they're doing is really just exercising their First Amendment free speech rights. So we wanted to take that Puritan work ethic, which is to stand on a street corner and hold a sign trying to beg you for nickels, dimes, and quarters for hours, day in and day out, and convert that into purposeful economic work. And that's what our Community Works program does. That last year, 2020, our neighbors in this community earned $958,000.
That is incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
That's dignity right there.
Yeah.
These human beings.
And we don't tell them what they can go spend their money on. And some of them go spend it on, just like you spend it on crap. And you might spend it on drugs or alcohol. I don't know what you do, you know? But
I'm a wine lover. Yeah, absolutely. I'll admit it.
Yeah. Yep. No, we all have our addictions. They're just different, and they may not be drugs, but we're all addicts to something.
Alan is holding up his cell phone. Sure,
absolutely. The latest addiction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all are. Yeah. I took all social media off my phone, Aaron, at the end of last year after watching Social Dilemma, and it's it freed my life. Yeah,
I've considered that too, just like so many people. I think that's a really good idea, just for your mental health.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how MLF, Mobile Loaves and Fishes, is able to perform from a cost basis versus how much it costs the government to handle the homeless problem?
Well, on average in the United States of America, to build a HUD-approved housing unit is $255,000. Now, I'm not going to get this number right, but I'm going to get close. In California, it's about $600,000. Okay? Wow. Just because of the regulatory environment that exists. But in Austin, it's about $250,000bucks. Everything that we do out here, all the buildings, all the infrastructure, all the units, comes out in the low $80,000 per unit. Mm-hmm. And that includes buildings and everything, farms, movie theaters, on and on. And then there's what we call the philanthropic return on investment. What do you get out of that? Because 100% of the people that live on the streets, with a few exceptions, are going to have to be subsidized for the rest of their lives. They're broken. They're disabled. If you can get them on government assistance like SSI or SSDI, they're going to earn a little less than $800 a month, no matter where you live. And I'm pretty doggone sure you can't live in Orange County or the LA area for that kind
of
cash.
You're right about that.
Yeah. And so, you know, so they have to be subsidized. So you and I really don't mind subsidy, but is there a community or is there a philanthropic return on investment? And we have an extraordinary philanthropic return on investment.
That's outstanding. And I think what you don't see on paper, Alan, if the government provides a housing, that's putting them in a home. That's not necessarily putting them in a community where they have that support, where they have that infrastructure that you have, that they have a you know, a theater that they can go to, a garden that they can go and work in, a shop to make, you know, crafts and arts or whatever their skill is, to be able to have those opportunities also that you provide. You can't put a price on the dignity that also comes with having that. And which kind of leads me to my next question. And this is another thing that floored me about what you are doing there. Not only providing these human beings that, like you said, never chose to be in a situation where their family was completely disrupted by a catastrophic loss of a family member or family members that ended up homeless for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, what have you, to then give them a life of dignity and then also now give them a death with dignity. Can you tell us about Larry Taz Williams and what he has meant and done and led to the memorial that you have there as well in your community?
Well, he was probably 5'6" probably weighed 240-250 pounds. Had guns on him like this.
Yeah, I saw photos on your website. Yeah. You don't want to mess with him.
And, you know, they called him Taz for the Tasmanian devil. And and you could go into his camp when he was on the streets, and his camp was pristine. There wasn't a speck of trash. It was complete order. They could be sitting around at night drunker than a skunk. But no misbehavior. Mm-hmm. If they did, it was going to hurt. And so he was amazing. We lifted him up off the streets, and his RV was OCD pristine. Everything lined up like little soldiers. And his hospitality was extraordinary. Our maintenance staff, when they would go to do a maintenance call on his deal, would have to allocate about 2 to 3 hours because we knew the lemonade and the spaghetti or something was going to come out. And I was his medical power of attorney in November of 2013. And he was pretty big buddies with my wife, Tricia, who's fully engaged in the ministry. And he knew that when we opened this village that he wanted to be the first one to move in. That's how important this place. But he didn't make it in time. He died on November 20th, 2013. And when you die indigent, you're going to get buried in the pauper cemetery, and that didn't cotton with us too much. And so we claimed his body and cremated him, and that's when we bought the columbarium. And on Easter Sunday, 2014, we interred his cremated remains, and he literally became the first resident out here at Community First Village. And so now the Memorial Garden is named after him. We've got 20 or 25 people that have now passed away and that are interred in that columbarium. And we're going to have to buy a new columbarium here pretty quick in audit order. And people are signing end-of-life documents, appointing several of us as their medical power of attorney. I mean, think about that. I mean, the trust that it takes. You know, Steve, you'll be doing that with Aaron someday. You'll be having that conversation and going, look, here's what my wishes are at the end of my life. It's things that I've had. I 4 weeks ago, I just had a quadruple bypass, open heart surgery. And, you know, and you're having conversations with your kids, you know, around all of that stuff, especially one of my daughters who's our person. And, you know, this is what my wishes are going to be. And it's a powerful.
At this point in the conversation, we lost communication with Alan. Once we were able to regain the connection, we continued the conversation where we left off. At this point, how many residents are buried there now?
I believe it's 20, Steve, right now.
I just think that's amazing that you are now giving them a place to now die with dignity. And with class and in their community. Isn't that what we all want, to be buried where our loved ones can come visit us and so forth? So such a just a beautiful part of this whole story that I did not see coming. That is just amazing, Alan.
Yeah. Well, and I think it makes a difference to their dignity. And when we talk about living here permanent, we really talk about it in terms of infinity, man, forever.
Yep, absolutely. I know we are really pressed for time, so I want to make sure we throw out to our listeners that Alan is also an author. So, and you can find his book on the web. It's on Amazon, or if there's any other place, Alan, that you would like to send our listeners, it's called Welcome Home, One Man's Journey of Discovering the Meaning of Home. And so they can find it on Amazon, or is that for sale on your website, or where should they go to get your book?
It's cheaper on Amazon than it is on our website, actually. So, but they're welcome to go spend more money at our shop.mlf.org if they want.
Yes, please do that. Support the cause. Go to the website to get the book and read the book.
Yeah.
And there's also I heard in 2019, there was a documentary put out by the director Leighton Blaylock, and that is called Community First, A Home for the Homeless. I was able to find a really well-done trailer about the documentary. Is there a place where we can go find the documentary to watch?
I think it's showing at a number of PBS stations across the U.S. And particularly in California. And so people might, search their local PBS station for that deal. I don't know if you can purchase. You can purchase that DVD here. It's not on our online deal. But I'm just not sure really where to purchase that. But it's a pretty good little documentary.
Yeah, it looked very interesting. And to make a donation, you can go to mlf.org. That's mobileloavesandfishes.org, or Mobile Loaves and Fishes is the name of the organization. So to our listeners, please support them, and they can also volunteer if you're local, local to the Austin area. And I believe on your website, Alan, there are instructions on what to do and where to go and who to call or what have you if you would like to be a part of the volunteer program. Any other closing thoughts you would like to leave with our listeners here?
Look, it's all about caring for our neighbors. And if you want to mitigate this, instead of yelling at the mayor, go stand in front of the mirror and do the yelling there, because that's where the beginning of the end of this craziness is going to begin. It's with each of us. So point at that
that's
mirror,
awesome.
Man. Yeah. You need to get out there and do something.
Yeah. Well said. Alan, it really has been an honor. Thank you so much for truly making the world a better place. Aaron and I, that's the whole reason why we started this podcast, was to shine a light on humans that are doing extraordinary things. You know, we all have given a few dollars to a homeless person. We all have done little things. You have done ginormous things. You've committed your life's work to this, and thank you so much for representing human beings the way that you do. We appreciate all that you do. Keep up the good work. Give our best to Tricia, because I know that behind every strong man is even a stronger woman. So my hat off to her as well.
Steve, I have a different line.
Yeah.
Behind every great woman, there's just a man.
That's
well
awesome.
Said. So true it is. On that note, Alan, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. Please keep in touch if there's anything we can do. We'll get an update from you maybe next year and see what other crazy things you are doing as a serial entrepreneur. Thanks again, and
awesome.
Have a wonderful
Alan.
Rest of the day.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. Yeah.
Take
Hope
care.
To see y'all
thank
someday.
You.
Y'all take care.
Thanks, Alan. We'll come visit you sometime, I promise you.
Please. Yeah.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Special thanks to our guest, Alan Graham. Thanks to our producer, Noah Existe, and editor, Joe Tompoco. Our music was written and performed by Nadia Importante. Thank you so much for listening. If this podcast brightened your day in any way, please subscribe and leave us a comment. If you have a suggestion for a guest or simply have suggestions on how we can improve our show, please send us an email to betterplaceprojectpodcast at kindkindkind@gmail.com. Look for small ways to be kind to others this week, and that will help make the world a better place.
Make the world a better place. Make the world.